Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock and I'm your host. Acute leukemias of ambiguous lineage are rare and challenging cases with a poor prognosis. These cases have puzzled clinicians and researchers for decades, and their classification is generally quite difficult using traditional morphological, immunophenotypic, and cytogenetic methods. Unfortunately, this also means that the treatment patients receive can vary, with clinicians often relying on expert opinions to start either an ALL or an AML-based treatment regimen. And so I'm very pleased to be joined today by two authors of a recently published paper, and this is Dr. Aniko Sais, a clinical hematologist at Leiden University Medical Center, who also conducts research at the Department of Hematology, Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, and Dr. Roger Mulet-Lazaro, who is also from the Department of Hematology, Erasmus Medical Center, Rotterdam, the Netherlands. Both co-first authors on a new paper in Hemisphere entitled Transcriptional Profiling Directs the Classification of Acute Leukemias of Ambiguous Lineage into AML, BALL, or TALL. So welcome to you both. I'm going to begin for our listeners to perhaps ask you to explain what acute leukemia of ambiguous lineage, or ALAL, is and why it's such a challenging diagnosis for clinicians.
So let me start with this first question. First of all, thank you for the introduction and also for having us here. So acute leukemia of ambiguous lineage is a rare type of leukemia, which is characterized by that the leukemic blasts are impossible to assign to one single hematopoietic lineage. So the WHO has defined two main subgroups in this ALL leukemias. So the acute undifferentiated leukemias, where the blast doesn't really express any lineage-specific markers. And so the other subtype is called mixed phenotype acute leukemias, where the leukemic blasts express more than one lineage-specific markers. So, and why is it such a challenging disease? You already told in the introduction that the diagnostics is very complex. So it's mainly based on conventional diagnostic methods, flow cytometry, cytogenetics, and a limited set of molecular diagnostics. And actually, all of these methods can result in ambiguous results. And that's a problem because clinicians really would like to have a clear diagnosis, myeloid or lymphoid. So there we also now go to the second big issue. How could we treat this type of leukemias? So we prefer to choose based on a clear diagnosis, but when it's not possible, then we need to rely on our expert opinion or experience, but that's quite difficult sometimes. Well, last but not least, it's also a very challenging disease because of its poor prognosis. So acute leukemia of ambiguous lineage is characterized also by worse prognosis than the lineage-specific leukemias.
So on that, in terms of, you know, the expert opinion and experience, because this came up for a previous podcast on CAR-T therapy and some of the side effects that occurs, and that expert opinion can be an issue because it's often based on your local experience. And if you've had a very bad experience with your first case of ALAL, if that's how we can minimize the speaking of the terminology for the large acute ambiguous leukemias, how does that impact, like if you have a bad experience with a patient with ALAL, why would that matter? Is that also a local problem with your treatment? Because obviously the longer you are in a career, the more chance you're going to see more of these patients and you'll have a better way of going, okay, we should probably go more AML or versus ALL. Or really, is it just case-by-case basis?
I think both. So of course you have the experience of different cases, but of course each leukemia is quite unique. So you really have to look at these cases like case by case, and what you try to do when you don't have more information, just the conventional diagnostics, that you try to choose based on which markers are more expressed, even if it's an MPOL, because there is MPO expression, but there are a lot of different lymphoid markers like myeloid markers, then you are more likely to choose for ALL type T treatment. Or if you have some molecular things like BCR-ABL or 3-3, then that also pushes you towards myeloid or lymphoid type of treatment.
So that's a nice segue, because in your study, you begin to tackle some of those issues around ALL classification by using RNA-seq and transcriptomics. What motivated you to try and leverage RNA sequencing to reevaluate the classification of these acute ambiguous leukemias, and what key limitations of the conventional methods did you really aim to address with this approach?
So, well, we try to overcome the limitations of flow cytometry. The WHO and also the ICC uses a quite limited set of surface markers to diagnose a mixed phenotype leukemia or ALL. And if there is an aberrant expression of one of these markers, then it's already likely to put this type of leukemias into the corner of mixed phenotype. But that can be a misclassification. So that's one of the things. And furthermore, flow cytometry only captures the surface and some of the cytoplasmic expressed molecules. And RNA sequencing is, of course, a method which reflects the whole transcriptomic, which can actually show the functional identity of the cells. So that was one of the most important things which we were interested in, to be able to detect the real lineage behind these leukemias, and also to be able to pinpoint the developmental stage of these cells, to see whether these are arising from early progenitors or committed progenitors.
Okay, because one of the nice findings in your study is that the RNA-seq was very good at identifying some of the single nucleotide variants, or SNVs, and also the fusions, which is great, but not so good for the large copy number variations. And given that you said also it's so important to understand what lineage the ALL is, because that's going to really determine the type of therapy, whether you push the pendulum towards a myeloid versus lymphoid regimen. Can you elaborate maybe on some of the more technical, for the technical-minded listeners, what coverage of RNA-seq did you need to have to pull out these SNVs, and how confident were you from the transcriptomics to help classify some of these cases?
I will answer this question. So as you said, indeed, one of the other advantages of RNA-seq is that not only can you use it for transcriptional classification, but also to call mutations, right? So it offers a combination of information. Actually, we were quite impressed with how well it performed for single nucleotide variants and indels. I think we detected around 95% of those. But indeed, depth of coverage is a critical consideration when doing variant calling in general. But contrary to whole exome sequencing or whole genome sequencing, where the coverage is even throughout the genome, in RNA-seq, it really depends on the gene, right? So it's a bit more difficult to give a single number like 40x, 50x, because okay, it just will depend on the expression of the gene.
Okay.
What we did is, in our study, we sequenced actually quite deep. The samples that we sequenced went from around 100 million reads, so that's 2 times 50, so it's per end, to 180, so between 50 and 90. So that's pretty deep.
That's very deep.
Yeah, it's pretty deep. But I have to say, even in the ones with the lowest coverage, we still managed to identify all the variants that we knew were there based on other, like DNA-seq capture, et cetera. So it didn't seem that depth of coverage was an obstacle. And as I said, it depends on the gene. But most of the genes of interest, so that are known to be mutated in leukemia from other studies, those were expressed at least maybe 100 reads per base or something like that. So that was definitely more than enough to call mutations. The threshold that we used was we were looking for mutations that were at least supported by 4 mutant reads, and where the depth, total depth in that region was 10 reads. So that was the minimum. And as I said, for the most part, we achieved this threshold for most of the genes of interest. Now, the only exception were some lineage-specific genes, like PAX5 or WT1. Those were generally missing in cases that were classified as a different lineage. So for instance, PAX5 was not expressed in the cases that later, using machine learning, and I think we'll talk about this later, we classified as AML. So, but that was not really a problem because in principle, you don't really expect mutations in those genes anyway in those lineages. Now, so you also mentioned copy number changes. Actually, it did not perform so poorly for copy number, large copy number changes. So what we did in the beginning, so to validate all these results, we compared to other techniques and we compared to cytogenetics. And there we did see some discrepancies, but we were not really sure what was wrong here, either the conventional karyotyping or the RNA-seq. So we then did SNP array for some of these cases with discrepancies. And actually it turned out that the SNP array was much more concordant with the RNA-seq than with the cytogenetics. So I think for ARM level copy number alterations, it actually works very well. Now, the real problem is the small copy number alterations, because there you cannot distinguish, if it's a single gene, you cannot distinguish a gain or a loss from an increase in expression or loss in expression. And in BLL, for instance, you have Icarus deletions, and those we sometimes miss. So that was the biggest weakness, I would say.
But you would have picked those up from SNP arrays, probably, did you then?
No, actually, in a few cases, yes, because with SNP array for those, but I think in the majority, we had MLPA for
those
genes.
To pick those up. Okay, right. So it's funny, we're always trying to find one technique which has the answer to everything, but chances are we still have to use the combination of both cytogenetics and RNA-seq and MLPA and SNP array. If there was no limit to the amount of money we could spend, I guess we could have all the information. So it's how to get the most efficient answers out of the least number of techniques, I'm guessing. So that nicely brings us to the next part, which is obviously, you mentioned it, the machine learning and classifier. So in your work, you've taken the RNA sequencing and the transcriptomic analysis to develop a machine classifier called E-Cal or ECAL that helps segregate the ALAL cases to either ALL B or ALALP or ALALM, and the B, T, and M being for B cell, T cell, or myeloid leukemias. What were some of the key features you found when you did all this and that you segregated them into those three nice groups? What were some of the features you found when you applied your algorithm ECAL?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we trained this classifier. So just to give a bit more information to the listeners, what we did is we took hundreds of acute leukemias that we know were BLL or TLL or AML. And then we just trained this classifier on those. And we also validated this with external data and actually worked quite well. And then we applied this classifier on these ALAL cases, right? And then most of them were segregated into AML, BLL, or TLL, as you said. Well, what was quite interesting was that the ones that were segregated as AML tended to have more AML mutations, and same for BLL and TLL. So NPM1, DNT3A, the type of mutations was much more common in this ALALM than in the other subtypes. So it basically, we saw very good agreement between the machine learning guided classification and the mutational profile of those samples. Yes. However, there were obviously a few exceptions, right? There were some that did have strange combinations of mutations. So there was one particular case that, interestingly, according to the machine learning classifier, was really clear TLL. But then it did have DNT3A and IL-7 and NOTCH1 and IDH2, which, well, that's not a very common combination of mutations, I think, in TLL. But in general, it was quite clear. And then finally, there were a few cases that the machine learning classifier could not really assign to any lineage specifically. And those didn't really have many mutations and they didn't have any specific feature that was particularly unique.
If I can go back to the one, that case you said, which had both T and myeloid mutations, I'm guessing your classifier can't distinguish if there's actually like a myeloid clone and a T cell clone in the same population because you mixed it up. So there's no way you can tell. You can't deconvolute those samples because, I mean, unless you did single cell, which is it wasn't done. But is that a possibility, or is that just really, it could just really be an odd case which has co-mutations of both myeloid and lymphoid, or there is the possibility of having two very separate clones in the same patient?
No, as you said, that our classifier does not distinguish that. In fact, what we did is we included some bilineal cases. I think Aniko mentioned this before, and we also applied this classifier to them. And actually, it didn't really seem to matter whether they were bilineal or biphenotypic. So most of these bilineal were quite neatly classified into one category or another. No, this classifier is not designed to distinguish these two clones of populations. What you can do, of course, is to look at the VAF of these mutations. And if that was the case, you would expect that some of these mutations have low VAF. I don't remember, however, from the top of my head, I didn't mention VAF stands for variability frequency. But I don't remember from the top of my head.
No, it's okay. Because I can imagine, you can look at all the myeloid VAFs and say, okay, they've all got this frequency, which might suggest that there's a subclone versus all the lymphoid mutations. So, I mean, you reported that there's these three cases. Like, after doing all that, there are three cases which could not be classified as one of the three lineages. And you called them multi-lineage. And you suggest that these are actually the true ALAL cases with lineage ambiguity. And I know that you in your introduction, you gave two hypotheses about these schools of thought about what the cell of origin means. And so what does it mean? And what are some of the specific challenges in managing those particular patients who truly do exhibit this broad lineage ambiguity in terms of the therapy?
Yeah, so we call them true ALALs, which is perhaps a bold statement, but that's what we at least conclude from our data. So indeed, when we apply this classifier, as I mentioned before, there were some cases, particularly these three, where we could not classify them into any lineage. And I also have to mention, we analyzed data from other researchers and we also encountered this type of phenomenon. And so what we did next, try to find the possible cell of origin, is we applied tools for transcriptional deconvolution like CyberSort or Base Prism with single cell data of healthy hematopoietic cells. We were trying to find what is the closest normal hematopoietic cell to this, the transcriptional profile of this cell. And for these three cases, we found a really high enrichment for transcriptional signatures of multipotent progenitors and stem cells. Whereas for the other cases, we largely found the signatures that match the lineage assigned by our classifier. So in AML, you mostly had monocytic or granocytic signatures, or in TLM or T-lymphocytic, et cetera, right? But in those cases, there was a really large enrichment for these earlier hematopoietic cell types. So we came to the conclusion, but of course, I mean, this is, we did not experimentally validate this in any way. So this is just based on transcriptional data. But we came to the conclusion that these true ALALs derive from earlier progenitor. So looking back in the literature, what we found was that already in the 1980s, two hypotheses were put forward to explain the mixed phenotype of these leukemias. 1982, Ernest McCulloch proposed that lineage infidelity is the result of the misexpression of certain markers in committed cell types. So for instance, a cell that has committed to the myeloid lineage for some reason misexpresses lymphoid markers. And in our cohort, this is what we mostly see. So there are cells that we can classify quite well into one lineage, but for some reason, they misexpress on the surface markers from another lineage, which is not surprising because, of course, the transcriptional networks, gene regulation of these leukemias are completely messed up. So it's not entirely surprising that this happens. Now, there was another hypothesis from Mulgreaves that proposed that there's a phenomenon he called lineage promiscuity, in which multipotent progenitors just express markers from different lineages. And so that happens naturally, but upon transformation, this ability is just preserved and or maybe even exacerbated. And then they just continue to express these markers from multiple lineages. And so in line with what I was saying before, it looks like these three cases that derive from multipotent or progenitor stem cells could follow such a mechanism. So that they have lineage promiscuity. They already express low levels of these markers before transformation, and somehow this has been preserved. So that's at least the model that we have in mind. Another thing that we'd like to mention is that, so I talk about cell of origin, but there are other groups that have identified mutations or genetic lesions that are strongly associated with lineage ambiguity. So particularly BCL11B rearrangements or ZNF. So it's not only the cell of origin, it appears that certain mutations can be a strong driver of this ambiguity as well.
I love the fact that you've gone back to read those papers and found those papers, but also, you know, humans love to categorize. We want to make sure things fit in a nice box. It has to be either or. And yet I think you kind of show actually it's both are right, both are wrong, right? So it's a bit of both. Mel Greaves' hypothesis is correct for these true, and I like the fact that you're bold enough to say true AL cases. And then Ernest McCullough is also correct for the other hypothesis where you have a more differentiated lineage cell, which then reprograms. And I think if there's anything we know from even hematopoiesis, you can imagine we used to have this beautiful dendrogram of like, this is the cell. And then we have, and then we forget about what happens in between. And then single cell pseudotime shows us a beautiful trajectory. And I'm guessing the same happens as well. So wherever you happen to have the right mutation is reflected in the myriad of mutations that we get and the types of cases that we have. All right, I'll keep going because this is great stuff. So the preliminary observation is that the treatment is consistent with ECAL classification, and this led to higher complete remission rates, so 80% versus 17% for non-matching treatment, so suggesting that when you do classify, you get a better response, which is great, which is amazing clinicians. I mean, Aniko, you said that you want to know because if you know you can treat the patients correctly. What are the next steps and the biggest practical barriers to moving this RNA-seq approach from this research environment into clinical decision-making for ALAL patients? And I ask that because if I did a search on machine classifiers, I'm sure that there's quite a few there. So what do you see the future and what would you like to see as a clinician?
Yes, you are right. Clinicians are thinking sometimes just really simple. I just want my box. So which treatment do I need to choose?
Yep.
And that's of course a little bit different approach than to know everything about the biology, but the two are linked to each other. So yes, we are really happy with these results, but again, we have a retrospective cohort, so it would be very nice if our results could be proven in a prospective way. So that's not a part of what we need for the technical implementation, but this is also something I think I would be happy and I think it's important to see. But yes, based on the data what we have now, we would argue for the implementation of RNA sequencing in the clinical practice. Well, actually in the Netherlands, in Leiden and also in Rotterdam, we already use this technique for the diagnostics of acute leukemia. In Leiden more for AMLs and in Rotterdam more for ALLs, but there's also a collaboration, of course. But now we are using this in the practice and we are also realizing that this is not something what's available everywhere. So you need infrastructure, which is important, but you also need the experience and the committed laboratory and medical staff to perform the analysis and also the data analysis and to improve the turnaround time, which is very important for the clinicians because now it's not that you have your flow cytometry the next day. To the results of RNA sequencing, you have to wait a little bit more. It's in our practice now around a week at fastest, but still that's not the time that you have if you have a patient in a critical situation. But I'm also happy to tell that we actually now working on user-friendly RNA sequencing analyzing pipeline, which will be soon available. So hopefully that will help to implement this technique also in center with less experience of analyzing this type of data. So these are, I think, the technical things for the implementation.
And what about the clinicians themselves? Are they embracing this as well in terms of like, we understand the merit of this?
Yes, sure. Of course, I'm working in an academic medical center. But in my hematological stuff, there is a molecular tumor board, and we discuss each leukemia case based on the molecular basis. So it's really that we want to understand the disease to be able to treat it well, of course. And there's also the link to the box type of treatment, to moving forward to precision hematology, where you can treat patients guided by your biology, your molecular results.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you about that in a moment because you touch upon that in your paper, but I also want to just reflect on, I think this is a consistent message when transcriptomics is being used, one of the bottlenecks around the world is having a bioinformatician to analyze the data. That time lag between, okay, even if the sequencing only takes practically a week, who's going to do all the data analysis and who's going to do that ECAL analysis in a timely fashion to then present it to you as a clinician to interpret quick enough? And I think, do you think AI has a place there? This is very speculative because, you know, we're getting more and more AI out there to help bring those reports and collate those reports so you minimize the handling. I don't know. I'll throw that out to both of you if that's a way to try and streamline some of this from the research space into the clinical space.
I think, Roger, I want to answer, but I think, you know, nowadays we cannot say that, no, there's no role for AI. So I think that that's something we really definitely should explore in the future, but
Roger,
we are not there
thoughts?
Yet, right?
You're not
Roger?
There. No.
Yeah, well, of course, AI is a very broad term, yeah. Right? So of course, machine learning is also part of AI. So there's already some AI in these. And the problem with a lot of this AI is also their black boxes, and especially all these commercial AIs, right? We have no control of the data. So that's also something that we have to be careful with. Yeah, so I think that there might be a future for AI, but there needs to be appropriate regulation and, of course, a validation of how this works in a clinical setting, right? Because if you have to put the trust in some fancy AI, you want to know what he's doing.
Yes, that's true. I
completely agree on that. Also with patients' right, of course. It's really data which you are sharing, important personal data, but also that it has to be a trustful method.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I like that. I think it's probably going to be there, but there's definitely a massive regulatory framework which needs to be put in place. But that's for another podcast, because I want to get back to your paper, because and you hinted at this as well in terms of targeted treatments, and your study actually looked at some of the mutations specifically in the patients and how these are often also targetable by FDA-approved or investigational drugs. And my question is, have you tested these drugs on ALAL models? How likely is it that a clinician who has this information that you get from ECAL will then add an investigational or repurpose an FDA-approved drug for a child with ALAL? And what do you think is and how likely is that in terms of also improving the prognosis?
We haven't tested ourselves on preclinical models, but if you search the internet, you can find, of course, a lot of publications about testing targeted agents in different types of hematologic malignancies. And of course, some of them are also part of the daily clinical practice, like FLT3 or BCL2 inhibitors in acute myeloid leukemia. And if you look at that, then I think that it's really reasonable to think that those type of agents also will work in if you apply them in ALAL of MPALS. So I think that that's really the future. What I've touched on that before, that we move from treating in clearly defined boxes, AML type, ALL type treatment, to move to precision hematology when you treat based on the molecular profiles of the disease. And actually to go there, what we need, in my opinion, is basket type trials, because we are talking about really rare entities. So it's not a possibility to design a prospective trial just on ALAL with all these different molecular findings and types of targeted therapy. So what you really would need is the basket type trials in hematology, where you can include different types of hematologic malignancies, but then you can treat them based on the molecular profiles. And this is also actually something which is already happening, but not broad, but more still in subtypes like TLL or other hematologic malignancies.
Okay. Well, looking back, the paper's published, and part of this conversation is also to try and have a little window into behind the scenes of how the paper was actually formed and written from the initial hypothesis to the actual publication in Hemisphere. For both of you, what was the most rewarding aspect of the project and any lessons you learned on the way about the nature of the work that you found surprising that you'd like to share?
Well, I think the most rewarding is to start in the beginning with the question, can we do this better? And what's the biological background? And how can you treat these leukemias better? And to start off with like questioning, how can we move forward? And then, well, in years later, but to come to something our equal, which is actually something which seems really to work and has really the potential to improve complete remission rates or even survival in these patients. That was for me the most rewarding. I don't know, Roger?
I think for me it would be quite similar, but maybe from a more technical perspective. I was quite impressed with how well we could use RNA-seq to call mutations, but also how well these mutations match with the lineage that was identified by transcriptomics. It was quite rewarding to see because, of course, you have this hypothesis, but when it works out, then, well, it is satisfactory, of course.
It's funny, most science is based on failure. Most of the science, we have an idea, we prosecute that idea, it ends up to be wrong, and we move on, and it can be quite like, you have to have very like thick skin in a lot of ways to be able to keep persistently ask questions. And I think it's great, as Aniko, you said, the result is ECAL, which, you know, when this user-friendly form is out there, I think it will be a game changer. And it's about spreading the word to get people to use it, because only when people use it and give feedback can you improve again, right? This is not the end. This is the beginning, I'm guessing. And so what's next step, Roger? You want to add some?
Yeah, so I just want to add one thing. So what Aniko mentioned, we're working on this pipeline that would make it easier to process everything from beginning to end with the push of a button. But what is already available, and we mentioned it in the paper, is a website where what people can do is, if they have already processed a gene expression data, they can introduce that in the website as a table, for instance, and they will get the result of the classifier. So that they can already do. But of course, all the other thing, mutation calling, et cetera, that's not available yet.
Yep. But that's a great start already, because then people can also use it on their independent cohorts and see, okay, how well does the ECAL work in my cohort as well, which might not be from the Netherlands, a population based in either Australia, where I am, or in the US, which is also different backgrounds of people and different genomics backgrounds, which might muddy the waters to some degree. Well, thank you both for joining us. Unless, Aniko, do you have any last...
Well, yep. You know, you also asked something about the lesson.
Yeah, you know, go. What's the lesson?
Maybe I have something to
yes,
add
please.
To that.
Yep.
So, you know, I think my lesson was that this type of research you cannot do alone. So it has really been a teamwork from different experiences, from immunologists, from cytogenetics, bioinformatics, clinicians, but also that it also needed like national and also in international collaboration to get enough samples, enough data. So I think that this type of research really truly needs a team effort. So maybe that's as a final.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I don't think there's an expectation for people to do everything on their own. I think there is, to a degree, when you do your PhD, you have to do everything solo, but then you diversify and you need to work with others. You can't be an expert in everything. You need to bring people in, get them enthusiastic, understand the question, the challenges. And I think time and time again, I'm so surprised by the generosity of so many scientists out there. When you go to EHA congresses and you have a question, if they don't know the answer, they will go, I don't know what you need, but I know someone who does. And I think I'll introduce you to that person. And I think that's pretty an amazing community out there for hematologists, that they will genuinely try and help you answer your questions. And I think that is the only way forward. And if we don't, it's a disservice to the patients who rely on us to actually improve outcomes, which we're all here for that. So it's great. So great lesson. Team science. And I like how, you know, clinical, fundamental, basic researchers can come together, and all those barriers which people say are there are actually probably more false than reality. So again, thank you both for joining us on the Hemisphere podcast. It was a wonderful conversation. I'm looking forward to the next iteration of eCal and the user-friendly version, and I'm wishing you all both all the best for the next project, which you work together, I'm sure. And thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.